Welcome to Hub History, the show that brings you fascinating stories from Boston history. This is episode 23, The Groundbreaking Grimke Sisters. Hi, I'm Jake.
And I'm Nikki. This week, we're going to talk about two trailblazing sisters, Sarah and Angelina Grimke, who were born into Southern society in Charleston, but became abolitionist, feminist, radical Bostonians.
I think they would have made Abigail Adams proud.
Yes. But before we get into that, it's time to take a look at what's coming up this week in Boston history.
Monday is April 3rd, and on April 3rd, 1776, John Warren accused the evacuating British troops of poisoning medicines that they had left behind for the rebels to find. Like his recently deceased brother Joseph, the Firebrand Patriot leader, John Warren was a medical doctor, so he was called in to evaluate what had been left behind. I went into the workhouse of the town of Boston, lately improved as a hospital by the British troops stationed in said town, and upon examining into the state of a large quantity of medicine there left by them, I found a great variety of medicinal articles lying upon the floor. Amongst these medicines, I observed small quantities of what I supposed was white and yellow arsenic intermixed, and then received information from Dr. Daniel Scott that he had taken up a large quantity of said arsenic from over and amongst the medicine, and had collected it chiefly in large lumps, and secured it in a vessel. Upon receiving this information, I desired him to let me view the arsenic, with which he complied, and I judged it to amount to about the quantity of 12 or 14 pounds. I more minutely examined the medicine on the floor, and judging them to be rendered entirely unfit for use, I advised Dr. Scott to let them remain and by no means meddle with them, as I thought the utmost hazard would attend to the using of them. We'll link to Dr. Warren's letter in this week's show notes at hubhistory.com/023. It's hard to be sure whether this was an attempt at chemical warfare or whether it was a propaganda campaign by the Patriots, but there are a number of references to poison medicines in post-evacuation Boston.
Famed attorney and former U.S. Senator Rufus Choate appeared before a legislative committee on April 4, 1851, on behalf of the people living in the western part of Roxbury. Remember that Roxbury was not a part of Boston until 1868. At this time, Roxbury had recently reorganized with the city government and was undergoing rapid industrialization. Residents of the western part of town resented these changes and were petitioning the Legislative Committee on Towns for permission to withdraw from Roxbury and become a separate agricultural town. Choate's emotional appeal concluded with, "Give us, gentlemen, the government we seek, and this town will do for Roxbury what, thus far, the matchless beauties of Roxbury herself have been unable to do for herself. Gentlemen, it will do more. It will allay excitement. It will reopen fountains of feeling. It will enable men to know who they are and what they are. It will cover you with the gratitude of thousands unknown to you by sight or name, with no vote to honor or reward you, but who will yet thank you, and the government for whom you act, for the performance of a great beneficent deed, I think, too long delayed." The appeal was successful, and West Roxbury was incorporated as an independent town later in 1851. It lasted 2 decades, being annexed into the city of Boston in 1874. We'll have a copy of Choate's speech in the show notes this week.
Wednesday is April 5th. On April 5, 1859, George Snelling testified in front of the state Senate. He wanted the recently approved project that would fill in the tidal back bay and create a new luxury neighborhood to include a lake or lagoon in the middle. His testimony emphasizes that the citizens of Boston at that time valued keeping the space open for a free circulation of air from the west for the sake of the health of the citizens. Instead of building homes on the entire back bay, he favored a plan that would preserve a 700-foot-wide saltwater lagoon in place of today's Commonwealth Avenue. He said, "Your memorialist will conclude by earnestly entreating your honorable body to pass some enactment which will allow of a modification before it's too late of the plan of building on this Back Bay territory, so as to leave a wide area of water in the central part, communicating with the full basin." The petition was unsuccessful. We'll have a link to Snelling's testimony, as well as a picture of the plan he favored, in this week's show notes.
As a 19-year-old Harvard student, John Adams was learning about simple machines on April 6, 1754. Except for the 18th century language, his notes sound pretty much like what I learned in school. "The nature of the pulley, axis in paratrochio, an inclined plane explained, which all depend on the laws before, laid down that the quantity of matter in the weight bears the same proportion to the quantity of matter in the power as the distance of the power from the center of motion to the distance of the weight from said center. We know the axis in paratrochio by the somewhat simpler modern name, wheel and axle. This lesson on the wheel, pulley, and inclined plane was sandwiched between classes on the lever, the screw, and the wedge. The concept of these six simple machines originated with Archimedes, was refined in the Renaissance, and has been taught almost unchanged ever since. Fun! Check out this week's show notes at hubhistory.com/023 for a link to the entry in John Adams's diary.
Friday is April 7th. On April 7th, 1851, a young man named Thomas Sims went on trial in Boston under the Fugitive Slave Act. As you might recall from episode 16, abolitionists would attempt to purchase Sims' freedom and even attempt to free Sims by force. As an ally said, "At the time of the rendition of Sims, money enough was raised and pledged to ransom him, but Mr. Potter refused to sell him at any price. He demanded that the case should be executed and Sims should go back. He wanted to humble Boston, and he did most thoroughly. A simple slaveholder of Savannah had all the city officials and police force harnessed to his work at their own cost, and he spurned their money." The plan failed, and Sims was forced back into slavery in Georgia, where he was welcomed with 39 lashes across his bare back. To hear more about the Sims case and the similar fugitive trial of Anthony Burns, listen to episode 16 at hubhistory.com/016.
On April 8th, 1776, Patriot leader Joseph Warren was laid to rest for a second time. Warren was one of the central leaders of the rebellion against British authority in Massachusetts, becoming involved with the Sons of Liberty, serving on the Committee of Correspondence, and eventually serving as president of the Massachusetts Provincial Congress, the revolutionary shadow government ruling the colony outside British reach. After hostilities began with the battles at Lexington and Concord, he was commissioned as a major general in the militia. In June of 1775, he fought in the Battle of Bunker Hill as a private, leaving the tactical leadership to more experienced officers. Before the battle began, he said, "These fellows say we won't fight. By heaven, I hope I shall die up to my knees in blood." He would get his wish. With the rebel forces out of powder, he was among the last defenders of the redoubt atop the hill, fighting to hold off the redcoats long enough for the main body of the army to escape. As the British overran his position, he was shot in the head, bayoneted beyond recognition, and buried face down in a shallow grave. After the British evacuated Boston the following spring, his brothers and his close friend Paul Revere found his body on Bunker Hill. After a formal funeral procession, he was laid to rest in the Granary Burying Ground on April 8th. He would eventually be buried two more times, but we'll have a future episode on the four burials of Joseph Warren. You can find a picture of his 1776 funeral procession, as well as his eulogy, in this week's show notes.
Finally, Sunday is April 9th. On April 9th, 1912, Red Sox pitcher Casey Hageman took the mound at Fenway Park. In three pitches, he struck out Dana Wingate. Wingate was a sophomore on the Harvard baseball team, and he was the first batter to ever take the field at Fenway. The Sox were christening their new ballpark in an exhibition game against Harvard a few days before their season opener against the New York Highlanders. With a cold wind and intermittent snow, neither team played well. The Crimson managed only one base hit, while the Sox stranded 12 runners. In the end, the game was called at 2-0 in the Red Sox favor after six innings. In the days before lights allowed evening baseball, the cold and encroaching darkness convinced everyone it was time to call it a day. Harvard got their revenge in 1916 when they defeated the world champion Red Sox in an exhibition game at Fenway. A century later, the 2012 Harvard team marked April 9th with batting practice at Fenway Park. We'll have a link to a Harvard Crimson story about the game in this week's show notes at hubhistory.com/023. And now, let's meet the Grimke sisters.
Picture it. Boston, March 7th, 1870. A snowstorm blows through the city on election day, But when you gotta vote, you gotta vote. 42 women line up with male escorts, each presented with a bouquet of flowers. Angelina and Sarah Grimke lead the group through the blustering snow to their polling place in Hyde Park. And I'm not sure about this, but I think the snow was 10 feet deep, and they walked uphill both ways. While onlookers both cheer and hurl insults, the men stand back, and each woman drops a completed ballot into a special receptacle that was set aside for the occasion. The group reformed and marched away, and their invalid ballots were thrown out. It was a small protest, mostly done in vain, but it did attract some publicity, and the Grimkes made their point. Women are rational beings, created equal to men, and deserving of equal rights. There are so many remarkable things about the Grimkes, and for me, the story begins with where they came from. Angelina and Sarah were born into a wealthy, slave-owning family in Charleston, South Carolina, 2 out of 14 children. Born in 1792, Sarah is 12 years older than Angelina, born in 1805. They come from an illustrious lineage. Their father personally petitioned King George III on the infringement of colonial rights. Clearly, he was not successful, and so he served in the war as a lieutenant colonel and fought at
the Battle of Yorktown, 1781.
A lawyer, he went on to serve as a judge on the Supreme Court of South Carolina. And her ancestors on her mother's side included 2 colonial governors and a speaker of the Commons House Assembly. All that to say, these are 2 women who would have had it made if they decided to stay home, accept the status quo, marry rich planters or politicians, and birth a string of Confederates. At least for several decades until the Civil War broke out. They could have been literal belles of the ball. Now, before the story progresses too much, I'm going to mention 2 of their brothers, as their actions had a strong impact on the sisters. The first is Thomas Grimke. He was a scholar, philanthropist, and member of the American Peace Society and the American Colonization Society. When Sarah was young, he supplemented her limited education by sharing his own lessons with her, giving her the idea that she could have scholarly pursuits too. She, in turn, had the same influence on Angelina. More on the other brother, Henry, later.
John Grimke, their father, owned several hundred slaves, so we can assume he was a strong proponent of slavery, and he wasn't too keen on the education or advancement of women either, as evidenced by Sarah getting her lessons from Thomas. From a very young age, Sarah was appalled by slavery, and it's interesting to think how that would have happened given her surroundings. Later in life, Sarah remarked that at around age 5, after seeing a slave being whipped, she tried to run away by boarding a steamer to a place where there was no slavery. In her own words, "We had many outdoor enjoyments. I, however, always had one terrible drawback. Slavery was a millstone about my neck and marred my comfort from the time I can remember myself." As Sarah was a strong influence on Angelina, both sisters developed close relationships with the enslaved people in their household. In defiance of the law, and their parents, they taught several slaves to read and write. In 1818, at age 26, Sarah accompanied her father to Philadelphia as he sought medical care. Though raised Episcopalian, Sarah became acquainted with Quakers and was drawn to their liberal views on slavery and the belief that women are equal to men. She also took to the simplicity of the religion and lack of hierarchy. When her father died, she returned to Charleston, but she brought this influence home to Angelina, and the sisters strengthened each other in their views.
I have to imagine that she would have found Charleston to be absolutely stifling after getting a taste of the liberal society in Philadelphia.
Yeah, it'd be like if we left Boston today. 3 years later, in 1821, Sarah relocated to Philadelphia, and Angelina joined her in 1829. The sisters became very involved in the Quaker community, fully adopting the lifestyle and religion. But surprisingly, they soon grew too radical even for the Quakers. Angelina began attending anti-slavery meetings, a setting in which women could take on leadership roles. Violent riots and demonstrations against abolitionists took place in New York and Philadelphia, and even in the liberal stronghold of Boston, anti-abolition sentiment could be fierce. When Frederick Douglass appeared at Tremont Temple in 1860, a white mob rioted to try to prevent him from speaking out in favor of abolition. In 1835, William Lloyd Garrison published an appeal to citizens of Boston to repudiate all mob violence, and Angelina felt compelled to respond with a letter of support stating, "The ground upon which you stand is holy ground. Never, never surrender it. If you surrender it, the hope of the slave is extinguished." She declared that agitation for the end of slavery must continue, even if abolitionists are persecuted and attacked, because, she said, "This is a cause worth dying for."
Garrison published Angelina's letter without asking for her permission. Immediately, both sisters were heavily criticized by the Quaker community, which did not condone violence and rioting for any cause, and generally frowned upon outspoken activism on matters not tied to religion. The sisters had to choose: rescind the letter to maintain good standing in the Quaker community, or actively work to end slavery. And thus their career as public speakers began. The abolitionist Theodore Weld, who Angelina would marry in 3 years' time, trained the women as public speakers. And just a quick footnote. You might think that someone as radical as Angelina would have ended up a spinster, but they were a perfect match, just like John and Abigail. They described their marriage as not merely, nor mainly, nor at all comparatively to enjoy, but together to do and dare, together to toil and testify and suffer. It's probably the most romantic thing I've ever read. With that relationship budding, the sisters embarked on a tour from Philadelphia to New York and New England, on which they addressed mixed gender audiences. And lest we forget the context of the time, two women speaking on political issues was already shocking. And they were speaking on abolition, and they were speaking to men. This was unheard of.
Absolutely. And whenever they were criticized, which was often, they argued that women had just as much of an obligation to be civically involved as men did, and they cited women from the Bible as examples of civic and religious leadership. Many were not convinced. On July 17, 1837, in Amesbury, Massachusetts, two men challenged Angelina to a debate over slavery and women's right to participate in the public sphere. It was likely the first public debate of this type between a man and a woman in America.
Hard to believe we had three in 2016.
And similarly, an audience member described Angelina as calm, modest, and dignified in her manner, and proclaimed her the winner. She had, with the utmost ease, brushed away the cobwebs which her puny antagonist had thrown her way.
Wrong. Sorry, I got a little carried away.
Ahem. One of the things that made their speaking tours so successful is that, unlike most of the white abolitionists, they came from the South. They grew up in a slave society. They could speak on the evils of slavery not only from an intellectual viewpoint, but also from their own emotional memories of what they witnessed.
During this time, Angelina was also writing. In 1836, she published Appeal to the Christian Women of the Southern States. She wrote this piece to speak directly to her old friends and neighbors in South Carolina to become active participants in the movement to end slavery. She wrote, "I know you do not make the laws, but I also know that you are the wives and mothers, the sisters and daughters of those who do." She advised them to read on the subject, to pray over it, to speak on it, and finally, to act on it. In other words, to follow her path. When copies of the appeal reached Charleston, they were publicly burned, and local police warned her mother that Angelina would be imprisoned if she ever set foot in the city again. Sarah did not have the oratory skills of Angelina, but she was an equally powerful writer. In Letters on the Equality of the Sexes, which appeared in the New England Spectator, she wrote, "All I ask our brethren is that they will take their feet from off our necks and permit us to stand upright on the ground which God designed us to occupy." For the Grimkas, abolitionism and feminism were intertwined causes that could not be separated. To effect change that would lead to the end of slavery, they had to have power, to have equal voices. And so they took a two-pronged approach that placed them among the most radical of their day. Undoubtedly, their views on feminism hurt their abolitionist cause, as it turned off the male moderates. But that is precisely why they needed to step out of what was considered to be a woman's proper sphere.
So, in the spirit of going big or going home,
which Angelina could not actually do without being arrested,
they took it to the State House. On February 21st, 1838, Angelina became the first woman to address a legislative body in the United States. I stand before you on behalf of the 20,000 women of Massachusetts whose names are enrolled on petitions which relate to the great and solemn subject of slavery. In her speech, she pleaded the cause of the African American, describing the cruelty she had seen with her own eyes in her native South and the racial prejudice she saw around her in the North.
We have to acknowledge that there was extreme racism in the women's suffrage movement, and that many abolitionists were advocating for the end of slavery, but not for racial equality. And in this regard, the sisters were, again, among the most radical. They truly believed in equality, which they not only wrote and spoke about, but backed up with personal action that we'll get into in a few minutes.
Later in 1838, newlyweds Angelina and Theodore attended an anti-slavery convention in Philadelphia. You might think that such a gathering would be tolerated in Philadelphia, but amidst rumors of whites and blacks parading arm in arm down city streets, on the first evening of the event, a hostile crowd had gathered outside the convention hall and began throwing stones and other objects against the windows. And still, Angelina spoke out against slavery. "I have seen it. I have seen it. I know it has horrors that can never be described." The next evening, the mob set fire to the building, ransacked the anti-slavery offices inside, and destroyed all records and books that were found. The speaking tour took a terrible toll on Angelina's health, and after the event in Philadelphia, the family opted to focus on writing rather than speaking, and education. Though they came from wealth, and Theodore from Northern society, the three were just too radical to be accepted, and they had a lifelong struggle to support themselves financially. Over the next few decades, the sisters and Weld earned a modest living as teachers, often in schools that Weld established. But lest you think they kept a low profile, they continued to shock by experimenting with pantsuits. Unfortunately, like many others, they eventually opted to return to dresses, as they could just not be taken seriously, in pants.
They finally retired to Hyde Park, just outside of Boston, in 1864. Post-Civil War, the sisters' activism switched to women's rights, but in 1868, their views on racial equality were truly put to the test. Angelina came across an article in the National Anti-Slavery Standard that discussed a black student at Lincoln University named Archibald Grimke, a former slave, as evidence that the intellect of blacks is equal to that of whites. Angelina wrote to Archibald immediately, and within a week received confirmation that he and his two brothers were the sons of Henry Grimke, and therefore the nephews of Sarah and Angelina. Henry had a long-term relationship with an enslaved woman, Nancy Weston, after becoming a widower. They lived together discreetly on a plantation outside of Charleston, and he was a father to his sons, teaching them and Nancy to read and write. In this period, South Carolina discouraged manumissions, the act of an owner freeing a slave, by requiring slaveholders to petition the legislature for each case. As such, Grimke never freed Weston or their children. On his deathbed in 1852, Henry tried to protect his second family by willing Nancy, who was pregnant with their third child, John, and the two sons, Archibald and Francis, to his son and heir, Montague Grimke, from his first marriage. He directed that they be treated as members of the family. Henry's sister and executor of his will, Eliza, brought the family to Charleston and allowed them to live as if they were free, but she did not aid them financially. Nancy Weston took in laundry and did other work, and when the boys were old enough, they attended a public school with free blacks.
But 8 years later, in 1860, Montague claimed them as slaves, bringing the boys into his home as servants. Later, he hired out both Archibald and Francis. After Francis rebelled and Montague sold him, Archibald ran away and hid for 2 years with relatives until after the end of the Civil War. After the Civil War ended, the three Grimke boys attended freedmen's schools, where their talents were recognized by the teachers. They gained support to send both Archibald and Francis to the North. To discover mixed-race relatives, the children of a white man and an enslaved woman, was fairly common for Southerners, and the normal course of business was to look the other way. or if you were a liberal, to acknowledge, but keep a good distance. Sarah and Angelina embraced the boys and their mother as family, helping them secure sponsorships to Howard and to Harvard. John chose to move back to the South and lost touch with the family, while Archibald and Francis went on to have significant professional achievements. Fortunately, the Grimkes did live to see the passage of the 15th Amendment in 1870, and still had the wherewithal to test its gender-neutral language by attempting to vote.
And as a refresher, the text of the 15th Amendment is, "The right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude."
Sarah Grimke died 3 years later at the age of 81, in December of 1873. Angelina, who'd been paralyzed for several years because of strokes, died on October 26th, 1879.
If it feels like we've covered a lot of content here, it's because we did. There is so much to get into with the Grimkes because they had careers that spanned 5 decades of advocacy on multiple topics. I mean, we didn't even get to touch on how they were eventually expelled by the Quakers. And their letters and writings are so brilliant and still relevant. We'll have some further reading for you in the show notes, but first, let's share some listener feedback.
Last week's interview with Brooke Barbier seems to have reignited the debate on Twitter between John Adams and Alexander Hamilton. After I name-checked him in the show, Alexander Hamilton said, "I'm kind of a big deal. People know me. Thanks for the shout-out, despite your fierce defense of John Adams." And he threw in some criticism of the way I pronounce GIF just for good measure. With manners like that, it's no wonder he managed to get himself shot in a duel. John Adams heard Brooke's criticism of him and immediately tweeted, Dude, you should have cut the podcast right there. Thanks for the Team Adams shout-out, though. He also DM'd Brooke to make it perfectly clear that they aren't friends. If you'd like to see the Adams-Hamilton rivalry play out on social media, we'll have links to their respective Twitter accounts in this week's show notes.
And now, it's time to announce the winner of our tour raffle. As a reminder, the winner gets a Back Bay Deconstructed tour led by us. The tour focuses on the process of filling in the tidal Back Bay and constructing today's neighborhood. This is a private tour for you and up to a dozen of your friends, and the winner is John McLaughlin. John, if you are listening, email us at podcast@hubhistory.com to claim your prize.
And to learn more about the Grimke sisters, check out this week's show notes. We'll have links to Lift Up Thy Voice, a book that explores the broader Grimke family, including Archibald and Francis, that you can purchase on Amazon. We'll also include an Amazon link to The Public Years of Angelina and Sarah Grimke, a collection of their political writings. You can learn more about the family and read some of the writings in the Weld Grimke Family Papers, 1740 to 1930, held at the University of Michigan. And we'll link to a short PBS documentary on Angelina. Find all that and more at hubhistory.com/023.
If you want to get in touch with us, you can email us at podcast@hubhistory.com. We're at hubhistory on Twitter and at facebook.com/hubhistory. Or you can go to hubhistory.com and click on the Contact Us link. And while you're on the site, be sure that you hit the subscribe link so that you never miss an episode.
That's all for now. We'll be back next time with a show about the Parkman murder and Boston's celebrity trial of the 19th century.